It's time for Big Blue Kickoff Live. Only on Giants.com.
And he's going to keep one downfield. Pass the defense is Cruz, who's got it at the 20. 15, 10, 5. Touchdown, Giants. 70 yards. Salsa time at Big D. Victor Cruz with another.
Play fake. Freeman back to throw. Under pressure. Heaves it downfield. Intercepted by Roll at the 5. Runs left to the 15. Cuts right back to the 20. Looking for a block up to the 30. And drag down there.
Manning takes the snap. Back to throw. Sidearms one left sideline. And it's caught for the touchdown by Reuben Randall.
Golzine takes the snap. Pass
intercepted as he threw it right. Picked off by a jumping Jason Pierre-Paul. And he runs it in for the touchdown. And finally, Carl, you can say you're down with JPP, the 28-yard TD.
Now here are your hosts, Anita Marks and Lance Meadow.
And welcome to Tuesday's edition of Big Blue Kickoff Live here on Giants.com. So glad you could join us with you for the next 16 minutes as we break down all that is happening here at Giants training camp. Alongside Anita Marks, I'm Lance Meadow. 201-939-4513 is the telephone number, 201-939-4513. You can also chime in on the conversation via Twitter, hashtag Giants Chat. You can follow and interact with us both directly at Anita Marks and at Lance Meadow, last name M-E-D-O-W. Let's start
that's
with some of the
tough
news.
One.
Say that again?
I said that's a tough one.
Which is a tough one?
How to spell your last name.
Well, listen, A is a common addition to the last name, so we sometimes need to clarify those things.
I'm
make it
I'm
easy
kidding.
For the audience.
I'm kidding.
In terms of spelling for the Giants, everybody seems to be okay in terms of how their names are showcased, but injuries is somewhat of a concern still.
Is it because Larry Donnell? I mean, you hear it pronounced both ways, which since I have a feeling we're going to be talking about him because he is making some noise here, and I think he's been the most impressive tight end. What side of the coin are you on? How are we pronouncing his last name?
I've always went with Larry Donnell.
There we go. Okay, great.
So I guess we'll stick with that throughout the program.
Yeah, so it's Donnell today.
And speaking of the tight ends, Xavier Grimble, their undrafted rookie, he's dealing with a hamstring injury. Odell Beckham Jr. is still dealing with a hamstring injury. They reportedly went for tests.
Right.
Everything came back okay.
Right.
You talked about this tight end crew. It really has been a different tight end every day, Anita, and Donnell was the guy that stepped up yesterday.
Yeah, absolutely. And keep in mind, he's got more game time experience. And the reason why is because he's been able to stay healthy. And that's a big key when it comes to playing in the NFL. You got to stay healthy. You got to stay active in practice. You've got to get some playing time. And that's one thing that Adrian Peterson, he just hasn't been able to stay healthy. But we've talked about this before.
You mean Adrian Robinson?
I'm sorry, Adrian Robinson.
Peterson's on the mind.
Yeah,
the Vikings are getting ready too for the season.
I'm sorry, I'm thinking fantasy football. I've already participated. Last night I was like sitting up and I was doing mock drafts till 1:30 in the morning. That's how I kind of prepare because I like to know kind of what's out there and where everybody's going and what round. And Jimmy Graham, I've participated so far in about 10 mock drafts. Jimmy Graham's gone in the first round in every draft. I'm like, what's going on here? My formula is not going to work this year, and that's getting Jimmy Graham in the second round, but he hasn't been falling. But anyway, back to the Giants. I've said this before. I don't think the starting tight end is on this roster yet. I think once teams start making cuts, I think that there's, out of the other 31 teams out there, I think that there's one team that more than likely has a lot of depth at that tight end position. It's going to be a numbers game. They're going to have to let somebody go that they don't necessarily want to let go, but they have to let go. And I think the Giants are keeping an eye on that.
Well, even if that happens, keep in mind, if they're not familiar with a West Coast offense, it's going to take time for them to adapt to this new offense. So, I mean, that theoretically could happen. It wouldn't surprise me. There's always some talented guys that get let go once they start to cut down the 53-man roster. But you're going to talk about a transition period once that guy joins this roster.
Can I just make a comment here that I love that our listeners and our fans of the program, like, promote our program on Twitter and tell other people to listen. That is really, really cool. And I appreciate that. Not only are you listening and calling in and, of course, being a part of the show, you're promoting the show along with us on Twitter. And that's really cool, guys. Thank you so much.
Well, hashtag Giants Chat continues to grow. And the way the website is set up, it's also a good opportunity for fellow Giants fans to interact with one another as we discuss various topics on this program. So obviously the listeners, the callers have done a real nice job ever since this program got up and running. Some other notes that I want to get to before we get to your phone calls at 201-939-4513. As I mentioned, keep sending in your tweets. We'll address a lot of your topics throughout the course of this program. Danny Langsdorf and Eli Manning addressed the media yesterday. And Langsdorf, his comments received a great deal of attention because he threw out the fact that the goal for Eli Manning this season, and this is a common goal for everybody, as Tom Coughlin mentioned this, is to get a completion percentage of 70%. Now, that is a very rare feat. If you look throughout the course of history in the NFL, Drew Brees remarkably did it twice in 2009 and 2011. Then you have to go to Steve Young in 94, Joe Montana in 1989. Alex Smith was right in between there in 2012. But it's not something that happens very often. However, they feel with this new West Coast offense and a great deal of emphasis placed on short passes, you put common sense together and you should be able to get your completion percentage
up. We talked about it last week, Lance, didn't we? All right. I mean, you know, this offense, we concerns about the offensive line. Yes. But how long is Eli Manning going to have the ball? I mean, the goal here is to have him get the ball out of his hands before that so desirable 3 seconds a quarterback likes to have in the pocket in the NFL. So we talked about the dink and dunk. Quick passes, getting the ball in the hands of very speedy, when healthy, receivers who are going to give you the yards after the catch. Dink, dunk, complete, 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 complete. Eli's a smart quarterback. You know, one thing that I'm assuming we're going to get into today is the percentage. Out of the 27 interceptions that Eli Manning had last year, 8 of them, Reuben Randle was targeted. And he talked about communication, miscommunication, and he ran the wrong route, and he felt that that's why Eli had so many interceptions, and that was just Gilbride's system. It's a difficult system. It's a difficult system to understand, digest, marinate in, and then try to execute. That difficulty's gone this year. So, you know, you're going to limit the miscommunication. Guys are going to go up to the line of scrimmage, Lance, and they're going to know exactly what pattern they're going to run, and Eli's going to have probably more faith that they're going to be open and that he's going to get the completion. And that's why I'm saying he's going to be a smarter quarterback or look like a smarter quarterback, because there's no denying that him and his wide receivers are going to be on the same page this year as opposed to years past. So I think it's attainable for him just because of the offense that is trying to be implemented here and the fact that he's a cerebral quarterback. I think it's an attainable goal. I know it's like, whoa, you know, only, what is it? I'm reading here. There's only, what, five or six quarterbacks that have ever reached that 70% rate. But I think because of the offense, because of the quarterback, because of the wide receiver core that's here, I think it's attainable. I don't think it's that far-fetched.
Well, I think the fact that they've been relying on the running backs, at least throughout the course of practice, that should also help him get his completion percentage up. I think the reason why many people are somewhat skeptical is you look at Eli Manning's career numbers, and I understand that they are implementing a new offense, but in terms of the highest spot he's ever gotten to, you're talking about 62.9, and his career completion percentage is 58.5. So, you know, we're talking about a very noticeable boost in the event he's able to get to 70. I think that this story really picked up a lot of steam because obviously in training camp you can only pick up so many storylines each and every day. And I mean, it's exciting that the Giants feel that they can put the expectations up there, but I think most Giants fans would agree at the end of the day, as long as the Giants win, it doesn't matter whether Eli Manning's completion percentage is 58, 62, 63, 67, or 70. Makes no difference. As long as this offense is fluid and as long as his decision making is on key. See, the biggest indication that I want to see in the preseason and during the regular season, listen, if he has an incompletion here or there, there's a miscue, that's fine. But you know what? If you can't go for the home run, dump it off to the running backs. And that was something that we talked about in great detail throughout the course of last season, where Manning sometimes was looking for the long ball when the smarter decision would have been, you know what, let me leave it to my running backs and let them do the heavy lifting. I think this offense, there's more comfort where if you want to go in that direction, you at least have the people in the right spot. So that's at least something that should bode well for him and the team moving forward. 201-939-4513 is the telephone number, 201-939-4513. Let's open up the phone lines. We'll also get to a majority of your tweets. Andrew gets us started in New Jersey. Andrew, good morning. What's happening?
Good morning. I'm putting all the work on you guys today. I wanted to ask a prediction for the practice squad. Of the five spots, if you could get two or three. Two would be good, but three would be very impressive. And the wide receiver, I forget his name, but there's a lot of talk. Paul's talking about this one wide receiver and the running back. But a couple predictions for the practice squad. Thanks.
All right, Andrew, appreciate the phone call. I mean, one guy that I'll throw out in the event that he doesn't make the defensive tackle cutoff would be Kelsey Quarles. But, you know, depending on how he performs in the preseason, I'm sure he'll probably get a great deal of interest around the league because he didn't come necessarily from a small unknown college. He played with Jadeveon Clowney at South Carolina. The wide receiver, Andrew, that I think Paul may have been alluding to, and I'm only going based on the fact that he's made some plays during the course of practice, is Corey Washington, the undrafted rookie out of Newberry, who's really shined. At times.
And you know what's funny is Odell's been asking me about him, Odell Beckham Jr. So do you think he'll make the team? Do you think he'll at least make the practice? I guess they're friends, so he's like, you know, what's the media saying? What's the media saying about him? And I said they're saying all positive things. So you know, he's made some friends here on the team, and they're all hoping that he makes the team as well, at least the practice squad. So, yeah, that's the one guy that kind of stands out to me.
Yeah, he would definitely be one, as I mentioned, Kelsey Quarles. In terms of a running back, see, Michael Cox is not eligible to go on the practice squad if he doesn't make the team because he appeared in too many games last season. So that's not an option. I mean, that would be a smart move to retain a young back, but unfortunately, he had too many appearances last season. So that's out of the picture right now. Andre Williams is making the 53-man roster. I mean, that's not really up for question. A guy like Kendall Gaskins, I believe he is eligible for the practice squad because he did not appear in a regular season game.
And the tight end that they drafted from USC, I think he's having a hamstring issue right
Grimble,
now.
Yes, correct, who yeah. We talked about off the top.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he would also be a guy that could make the practice squad too in the event that he's not healthy or they want to retain his services. So, I mean, those are a few names that come to mind to answer Andrew's question. If you have any recommendations, feel free to throw it out on Twitter and we'll throw it out there in terms of who potentially has an opportunity to make the practice squad. C.J. Barnett, a defensive back, who's an undrafted rookie out of Ohio State. You know, he perhaps is a guy to keep close tabs on. Another one who I think has had some flashes here or there during the course of practice is Jordan Stanton, the defensive end out of James Madison. Those are the few names to me that I would keep close tabs on. But the usual suspects, you have to understand, if they don't make the roster, they're not going to be able to go on the practice squad because they're just not eligible. And another player, actually, that we've also overlooked, I should mention, Dan Fox, the linebacker out of Notre Dame, who I think has a really good shot at making the roster, but there's a great deal of competition, as Anita and I have addressed over the last few weeks at that spot. All right, let's head back to the lines at 201-939-4513. 201-939-4513. Let's go to Timothy in Jackson, New Jersey. Timothy, what's happening?
Nothing. How are you?
Doing well, Tim. What you got?
I think the goal of Eli Manning completing 70% of his passes is impossible. I heard.
Well, it is going to be a tough task. I'm not going to disagree with you there.
I don't think it's impossible. There are, what, five or six quarterbacks that have been able to do it. It's either five or six, but and like we talked about a little bit earlier, you know, because of the way that this offense is being constructed and the scheme that Eli is going to be playing in, it is doable.
Well, but it's still a pretty long shot, I mean, in terms of Manning's career numbers. And keep in mind, I mean, look at what Aaron Rodgers has put up over the course of his career. And he's a guy that's played in somewhat of a similar system and has been a very efficient quarterback. And I'm bringing up Rodgers' numbers right now. He had one season when he got over 70, but that was a season when he only played two games and he wasn't the starter yet. So since he took over as the starter in 2008, the highest Aaron Rodgers has gotten, 67.2. That was in 2012. I would say, listen, mid-60s, 65, 67, I think that's extremely doable for Manning. 70, I think it's somewhat pushing it. Not impossible, I agree with you, Anita, but I also have to look at Eli Manning's track record and his numbers. that's pretty high expectations, especially year one in this offense. If we're talking about, hey, Eli's already grasped the West Coast offense 3 or 4 years in, hey, I could say, all right, there's comfort there. Transitional year, new offense, mid-60s, I'll give you. 70, I still think, is somewhat of a reach.
I'm not saying that it's not going to be difficult. All I'm saying is, because of this style of offense, it's doable. Is this doable in Gilbride's system? Heck no. But is it doable in this system and how I see this offensive scheme developing? Yes, it's doable. But, yeah, I mean, is it a reach? Yeah, but it's not impossible. The phone caller, the caller said it's impossible. No, it's not impossible.
In terms of Eli Manning's completion percentage and how this offense is going to be structured, one comment out of him yesterday really stood out to me, because he was asked about how, you know, the general trend throughout the media over the last few weeks has been, well, the Giants offense is going to be based on a lot of the short passes, as Anita just mentioned. The running backs are going to be heavily involved, and they're pretty much throwing all the Kevin Gilbride concepts out the window. And Manning sort of put to rest some of those rumors, which he basically alluded to the fact that, no, there's going to be some balance in this offense. It's not necessarily just going to be five-yard passes. So, you know, I think we need to keep that in mind. They're going to look to stretch the field. Are they going to do it as often as they were under the Kevin Gilbride system? No. But they're not necessarily going to say, Victor Cruz, just run 5-10 yards out, and we're going to look for you. I mean, there's a lot of guys on this offense that can stretch the field still.
Yeah, but, you know, football is if anybody plays chess, you know, football is a chess game. So, you know, the great thing about the West Coast offense is that it gives you the best opportunity to take what the defense is giving you, you know? And so if you go into a game and you're dink, dunk, and the corners still want to play 5-10 yards back and the safeties want to play back, that's fine. We'll dink and dunk all the way down the field. But eventually, if you're having success with the short and intermediate passes, and then all of a sudden those corners start pressing, those safeties come in, yeah, now you've got an opportunity with some speed that you do a little play action, and you go long. I mean, that's what's so great about the system. So, but will it be as often and as frequent as we saw with Gilbride's system? Absolutely not. And also, I think we're going to see a lot more, and I know we've talked about this, the running backs having a much larger role, not in the passing game as well. So, I mean, you get David Wilson the ball in some open space, forget about it. I mean, he's a game changer. He's a playmaker.
We've seen that even when he runs to the outside. Before he even catches the football, he's capable of changing a game. And I think that the versatility they have in the backfield is going to bode them well in terms of how this offense could operate. But, you know, I still think that you have to take your chances down the field regardless of what the West Coast offense presents, because you have a tremendous amount of upside and talent with some of the receivers that if you at least don't try to test the opposition, you sometimes can become predictable. And that was what I think Eli Manning was alluding to, the fact that, as Anita mentioned, listen, if the safeties are going to start to bite and the corners are going to start to bite, you know, we're not just going to then settle for the five-yard pass. We're going to go for the home run here or there. And Randall, we know, can stretch the field. Cruz can certainly stretch the field. Even a guy like Mario Manningham can stretch the field too. And Odell Beckham has the speed to get down the field. So I just named four wide receivers. To just tell them, hey, stay within a 15-yard perimeter, to me, would not necessarily be getting the most out of your offense. So I think that they at least need to keep that in mind too. Let's head back to the lines, 201-939-4513. Max is in New York. Max, what's happening?
What's up, guys? Thank you for taking my call.
Not a problem, Max. What you got?
I actually have two quick things. One, are the Giants, I feel like the Giants, especially on the offensive line, are finding themselves in a little trouble, because I feel like in the off season they kind of went quantity over quality. And I think that's starting to burn them a little bit, because you have all these backups. You have Jerry. You have all these guys, and they have a lot of offensive linemen. But I heard whoever was talking yesterday, I forget what his name, John Schmelk, I guess it was, and he was saying, you know, a lot of these guys aren't playing very well. So, you know, I feel like they're in a situation where they signed a lot of guys, but if you don't have more than five playing well, it doesn't really matter.
Well, keep in mind, we're still early in training camp, and I agree. I'm not saying that anybody's necessarily standing out amongst the backups, but you also bring in bodies, number one, to protect injuries, and number two, to foster more competition. So, you know, the goal is not necessarily, well, let's bring in 15 offensive linemen because 15 guys are going to make the roster, but you need competition. And the only way to get that is to bring extra bodies in the mix. So, you know, yes, you're always looking for quality, Max. I agree with you. But also, numbers can help, especially with the grind of training camp. And right now, the backups are not necessarily jumping off the page and jumping off the practice screen. But, you know, as they get more and more comfortable, as they have more and more practices with actual pads on, remember, they've only had two practices with full pads, you know, now we're really going to start to see who stands out. And priority number one is to get that starting five on the same page. Because, listen, in an ideal world, Max, you want to have your starting five offensive linemen out there for 16 games. In reality, that doesn't necessarily happen all the time, but let's see them get on the same page before you start to panic about, you know, what the fourth guard on the depth chart is bringing to the table.
Right. And just one quick thing. I hear that Walter Thurman's really stood out. With how their defense is implemented, they have the 4-3, so that's seven dedicated up front, and then you believe probably two corners and two safeties. You know, obviously that's just your base. Things change. But how would they work him into the use primarily slot? Would he potentially, if he's playing, you know, that
outseat Prince?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, there's talk that, you know, he's been so impressive. You know, could that happen? I mean, is that corner spot Lance Prince's corner spot? Is that his island? Is it Prince Island? Or is there a battle going on right now because of how good he's looked? It's a great question.
Well, I think that they're going to just try to get the best 11 guys on the field at the same time. And if that means to have one less linebacker on the field, then I think they'll make that sacrifice. If Walter Thurman gives you more versatility, then I would keep Prince, Dominique Rogers-Cromartie, and Thurman on the field, and I would just go with two linebackers and rely on your two safeties. I think that's something that Perry Fuel, I'm sure, is keeping in the back of his mind.
All right, so you could think that Thurman could – is he a guy that could potentially cover a linebacker? Because they're not the best cover linebacker. I mean, a tight end, excuse me.
Well, I mean, I think that he has the versatility to do that. You have to keep in mind, if you look at his track record, Seattle primarily used him as a slot corner. They didn't necessarily put him on the outside, and part of that was because they had better options on the outside, and they had more size. I mean, guys like Sherman, guys like Brandon Browner, guys like Byron Maxwell, you know, they're up there in terms of height. They're in the 6'1", 6'3", category. Thurman's not a tall guy. So, I mean, his height limits him in terms of how well he can match up with a tight end and a linebacker. And I think that the Giants, on paper at least, would like to pretty much keep him in that slot against an extra wide receiver or maybe a smaller tight end. So, you know, he doesn't have a great deal of experience on the outside. I think we need to keep that under consideration before we all of a sudden say, well, he's going to come in and he's going to be a threat to Prince. You know, Prince has been utilized on the outside much more so than Thurman. But if there's good chemistry between all three and he shows throughout the preseason that they can match him up on a receiver, a tight end, and a linebacker, then perhaps they'll toy with the idea of keeping him on the field more often. But I think he still needs to prove that. Although he has shined, I don't necessarily think he has the greatest resume that he can match up with any personnel groupings in the NFL.
All right. I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, Max. Appreciate the phone call. Thanks so much for tuning in. 201-939-4513. But with that being said, you know, as Anita mentioned, it's a good problem to have. I mean, any team in this NFL would love to have three corners that they could pretty much pick and choose to start two of them at any time.
Yeah.
Not many teams have that luxury.
And I know Paul Dottino named it the Ghidra package, but the way that Perry Fuel, defensive coordinator, the way that he loves to use the DBs and get as creative as he can with them, you know, it's just, as you said, it's a great problem to have because now he's got such great talent out there. What do you think over-under? I did see this. Over-under for Giants wins the season, 8 over-under.
Well, I mean, I think that's a good barometer considering their track record over the last few years.
Eagles over under 9 in both Washington and the Cowboys over under 7.5. Just FYI, where I was really going with this question is over under how many interceptions do you think the Giants have this season?
You know, somebody threw that out on a show a few weeks ago. It's tough to answer because interceptions, even for this team, Anita, they've come in batches. You know, some seasons you got a lot of opportunistic players. For example, two seasons ago when Stevie Brown had those 8 picks. You know, I mean, that's not something that you can guarantee is going to happen every season. Roll, to me, you know, is a guy that I think you could probably pencil in for 4 or 5 just because of his track record and his consistency. But, you know, Prince has been up and down. Dominique Rogers-Cromartie's been up and down. Walter Thurmond, you know, you don't necessarily know what you're going to get out of him. It's a very tough question. I mean, it's an interesting gambling question, as you threw out, Anita, but I don't even know where to start with the number because we've seen the numbers fluctuate so much. This secondary, though, on paper, it's got opportunism, if that's a word, written all over it, okay? Because I think these guys are very active. They take chances. So if they're in the right place at the right time, it would not surprise me if this group winds up collecting double-digit interceptions and then some, and even maybe approaches record numbers, because you got a lot of guys that bring something different to the table. And I'm not just talking about the corners. I'm talking about the safeties, too.
Yeah, I'm excited. Out of defensive line, linebackers, DBs, you take those three, obviously, levels of your defense. I'm probably more excited about the secondary than I am about anything else.
Well, if the secondary plays up to expectations, Anita, you'll probably start to get excited about the defensive line because you would assume that they're going to buy them a few extra seconds to hopefully wreak havoc on the quarterback. I think that's at least what Perry Fuel is anticipating. You know, everybody's concerned about the defensive line, and it's understandable. Those numbers in terms of sacks and hits have fluctuated. But if you think about Thurmond, Prince, and Dominique Rogers-Cromartie, as Max was talking about, on the field at the same time, I mean, all of those guys have pretty good cover skills. And that should give JPP and Matthias Kiwanuka and Cullen Jenkins and Mike Patterson, you know, it should hopefully give them maybe an extra step or two to get to the quarterback. 2-0. Yeah.
Quick note here, because I know that there's a lot of Terrell Thomas fans out there. He signed with Seattle yesterday, so... kudos to Terrell Thomas. In my 5 years now covering this team, he has to be one of my top favorite players to cover. Just a really good guy, great locker room teammate, always gave 100% on the field. For anybody to come back after 3 ACL surgeries and still play in the NFL is absolutely magnificent, because it's so hard to do. So just wishing the best for Terrell Thomas.
And it's a good fit in Seattle, considering Pete Carroll knows him from his college days, and Carroll knows all the injuries he went through. And, you know, we mentioned some of the Seahawks corners, and I threw this out on Twitter. To be a compliment to Maxwell and Sherman, that's not a bad situation for Terrell Thomas. And, you know, I was also going back with a few people on Twitter. Terrell Thomas had a very good season last year. He did battle some knee issues and the knee flared up, but when he was on the field, he was extremely productive. So, you know, for some Giants fans saying, oh, well, you know, Seattle's not necessarily getting a game changer. Well, they may not be getting a game changer, but to ask him to go out and play the slot corner in that system, I mean, that's an excellent fit for Terrell Thomas. So I would not be surprised if you hear his name if he's fortunate enough to make that final 53-man cut. 201-939-4513, 201-939-4513. Let's go to Marquise in South New Jersey. Marquise, what's happening?
Hey, how y'all doing this morning?
Doing well. How about yourself? What you got?
Yeah, I'm fine.
You sound stressed. You all right?
Yeah, I'm fine, man. I'm fine. I just woke up. Anyway, I just want to see who's making the best progress as a rookie, undrafted.
Well, Devon Kennard, I think, is the guy that probably should be placed at the top of the list. He's been all over the place. He's been active. It's a learning curve like any rookie. But this is a guy that has an opportunity to perhaps even get out there week 1, depending on how John Beeson recovers from the foot injury. So he would probably top the list in terms of all the rookies who have really stood out thus far.
Yeah, I think so, too. My next question, I'm going to give this question, then I'm going to take it off the air. Do you agree or not that Eli Manning is like one of the most scrutinized, over-criticized athletes in the world right now? Like, one, I ain't gonna say he is, but do you think he is one of the most scrutinized athletes right now?
Who?
And Eli, I'll take it off the air.
Appreciate the phone call, Marquise. Thanks so much for weighing in.
I think Tony Romo gets it 10 times worse than Eli Manning. Are you kidding me? I don't know. Listen, 27 interceptions last year. No, I don't. anybody else throws 20. If Mark Sanchez throws 27 interceptions, are you kidding? Like,
well, the New York market, that's a contributing factor.
Right.
So whether you're good or not, you're always going to be put under the microscope. And as you mentioned, the interceptions, even though they really stood out last season, if you look at Eli Manning's numbers, I mean, he has had seasons where interceptions have been up there. So, you know, I mean, I think when you take all those factors into consideration, he gets scrutinized to me, you know, just as much as guys who have had fluctuation in their numbers throughout the course of their careers. I would actually go the opposite way, and I'm sure a lot of Giants fans would agree, that on the flip side, he also doesn't get as much credit as he should. So he does get a boatload of criticism, but to balance it out, it's not always there where he gets enough kudos. You know, that's why he's sort of torn in between. He's right in the middle when you look at Eli Manning, the rankings, and just the general conversation about him overall during the course of his career. We're getting a few questions regarding some of the topics that we've brought up on Twitter. Let's throw some of them out here. Nasty Lefty, I see M. Farmer switching up his Twitter handle. How nice of him. At MFarmer20. When competition is between two bottom-of-the-barrel free agents, that is a problem. He's referring to the offensive line, what we were getting into a little bit earlier in the program. Hopefully Jerry's health, referring to John Jerry, improves and he plays better. Well, yes, you always want top-notch competition at every position on the depth chart, but, you know, it's very hard in the salary cap era, Anita, to have four or five guards that are all starting caliber. I mean, name me a team that has that type of luxury.
The Seattle Seahawks, and I'll tell you why. This is a hot topic I had on my radio show this weekend, and that is Marshawn Lynch holding out for the Seattle Seahawks. Idiotic. If you're playing for the Jacksonville Jaguars, who, let's face it, what's Jacksonville going to do this year against the Texans and the Colts? Absolutely nothing. Why are you going with Chad Henne as your starting quarterback? You're not going anywhere. You drafted Blake Bortles in the first round. With all that being said, if I'm Marshawn Lynch or Maurice Jones-Drew, who he's not there anymore, we know he's in Oakland, yeah, I'm holding out. I'm holding out because you know what? My motivation, I'm playing for money because I'm not winning anything. I'm not going to playoffs with the Jacksonville Jaguars. But the Seattle Seahawks are onto something here. I mean, I'm going to use the word dynasty. They very well have positioned themselves financially. And in order to make that happen, they've worked out their numbers a certain way. I mean, Marshawn Lynch is getting, he's got 2 years left on his deal, and it averages it to be about $6.5 million a year. That's how much he'd be making. Now, is that his worth and his value in regard to the grand scheme of where he ranks at starting running backs in the NFL? No, but you have to put a price tag on playing for a winning organization. Again, this is my opinion, okay? I'd rather make $6.5 million and play for the Seattle Seahawks than make $10 million playing for the Jacksonville Jaguars. Because you know what? I know if I'm winning, I'm happy. If I'm losing, I'm miserable. And so I'm going to put a price tag on that. And I say all this to say, when you have an organization that's not paying their starting quarterback $20 million, when you have an organization that has made an agreement and signed a contract with their starting running back, who's a top five running back in the NFL, and you're only paying him $6.5 million, then that's the organization that's got banging dancing bears on their offensive line. But not all teams are structured that way. You know, Eli Manning is making a pretty penny. Now look at the Baltimore Ravens, Joe Flacco making $20 million. You can go down the list of the quarterbacks that are making 15 and above. Now you're talking about Lance, a team that can't afford all five top-notch offensive linemen. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. But there are teams that work the money well, have done it a certain way to make sure that they are going to be, or at least try to be, a quote-unquote dynasty for the next 5 years if everybody buys in. Marshawn Lynch isn't buying in, and I think that's dumb.
Well, I'll take it even a step further. I'll say the reason why they're in that position is because they've drafted well over the last
absolutely.
Few years. I mean, that's when you have the financial flexibility, and you can basically pick and choose who you want to pay X amount of dollars to. You mentioned Russell Wilson. You know, Wilson's still on his rookie deal. Richard Sherman, before he signed this big extension, he was on his rookie deal. They let guys like Browner leave. Now, Browner was dealing with a suspension, but you have the opportunities and the ability to do that when you have drafted guys rounds 1 through 5 who could potentially be starters. So, to me, what shines and
Richard
what jumps
Sherman.
Out, correct? I mean, Sherman was a late pick, Earl Thomas, Cam Chancellor. If you look at that starting defense last year, I was pointing this out throughout the playoffs. I mean, you had half of that defense, which was drafted in the fifth round or later or undrafted. That's remarkable. So, you know, they have a great eye for talent. When you could do that, then you're right. As Anita mentioned, you know, you can afford to maybe have two or three guards on the roster that could very well start on three different teams. But when you're the Giants and you haven't necessarily drafted very well over the last few years, you don't have that luxury. So that's a big reason why there's competition, as many of you have talked about, after the starters, which doesn't necessarily jump off the page. I mean, if they drafted offensive linemen and they struck gold, they would not be in this position right now. But a lot of the offensive linemen that they drafted are not even on the roster anymore. So that just says a lot about some of the mistakes that occurred or some of the guys that weren't necessarily mistakes, but they thought were going to pan out.
But also, I mean, they really didn't take, Jerry hasn't taken, offensive linemen in the first three rounds in a while, just recently. Pugh, obviously. And now Richburg. But prior to that, look back. I mean, you know, you're taking guys in the fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh round and keeping your fingers crossed that they pan out and they develop. You know, you've got one of the best offensive line coaches here working for the Giants. So you hope that you draft somebody low and you bring him to your system and you work him out and he's a project and you teach and he learns and you pray that he develops into something fantastic. But talent is talent. Athleticism is athleticism. You can't teach athleticism, you know? You can't teach great feet work if somebody's feet aren't working the way they need to. And that comes down to athleticism. So, you know, just recently you're seeing Jerry use those first and third round draft picks on offensive linemen. And look what you're getting. You're getting guys that are going to be the future on this offensive line, finally.
I mean, he's used two fourth-round picks going back to 2011 on offensive linemen. One is James Brewer. That was 2011. He's been extremely up and down. Mostly was the following year. Unfortunately, mostly got hurt, and now he may actually blossom into a very reliable offensive lineman. But, you know, outside of that, you know, they've basically taken guys in the fifth, sixth, and seventh round.
Right.
And you're right. You do take a chance. You're not necessarily expecting them to be a game changer. But, you know, if you look around the NFL, you can assume that at least one of those guys, though, is going to amount to something. And the Giants really haven't had a track record where even one guy that you could point to has really developed into something. And that has been somewhat of a disappointment, because if you could get a gem in anywhere from the fifth or seventh round, you know, then that's one less guy you've got to pay on the open market. 201-939-4513, 201-939-4513. Let's go to Len in Maryland. Len, what's happening?
All right.
Hey, good morning, guys. Good morning, good morning, good morning.
Good morning, good morning.
Listen, I was pleased to hear that the quarterback coach threw out some numbers, at least the percentage of completions for Eli. And you guys brought up, you know, who had done that before in the NFL. And my guess is if we went back, looked a little deeper into the guys who have done it, we'd find out that those teams did very well that year. 70% completion gets translated into a lot of wins. A lot of wins. But let's see if we can take and help me with this. What does 70% for me like? I personally, I don't think it's going to be that high. I had a goal. I set this 2 months ago. I said 65%. I'd be happy with 65%. But what does 70% give us? How does it translate? Okay, wins. What are some of the other things that we gain from high completion rates from this quarterback?
Well, the offense is more fluid, I think, because if you're completing passes, obviously
less
incompletions and less stoppages of play.
And less interceptions, well, therefore.
There you go. There you go. I like that, Anita.
Yeah, less so you know, more completions,
yeah.
Less interceptions.
Okay.
So what's happening, you know, beyond that is now your opponent is getting their average line of scrimmage starting position.
Field position. There you go. Field position.
I mean, I think last year, I want to say, like, because of all the interceptions, the Giants opponents were pretty much starting their drives each series around the 40, 45-yard line.
And also special teams wasn't very good,
right,
too. That didn't help.
Right. Well, but you know, let's assume that the special teams aren't much better, Lance. if we're punting from better field position than we were last year, maybe we get more fair catches, you know, from the other side. It tilts the field. To me, besides more points, it tilts the field. It keeps the defense off the field. We're talking about time of possession. I'd like to see the Giants. I set a couple other goals here. I want 31 minutes a game. I want to average 31 minutes a game. I want to average four more first downs a game than we did last year. 70% gives us more first downs. I want to average four more first downs. Last year it was about 17 and a half. I want to get up around 21, 22, twice as many first downs as possessions. 11 possessions, I want 22 first, at least 22 first downs in a game. And I want, you know, 70% from Eli, 65, my number is 65. I'm going to go with 3,500 yards, 30 touchdown passes, fewer than 15 interceptions. That's what the 70%, that's what the 65%, more than he's ever had before. Much more than he's ever had before.
Well, but Len, keep in mind, you constantly bring up in terms of time of possession and the first downs, and that's great. But remember, if it doesn't translate into anything, those stats are meaningless.
Okay.
See, if you keep getting field goals, it doesn't matter how many first downs or time of possession.
If you go back to those six instances, I think it was six. I didn't count as you were running through them. Thank you for doing that, by the way. I hadn't realized it was actually as many as there were. But if you look back into that, Lance, what you're going to get is you're going to get twice as many first downs as you get possessions. I mean, you're going to get movement, and you're going to get scores out of it. Probably the average points for those teams was remarkably high. So, you know, it translates automatically. I shouldn't say automatically, but it translates into more points.
Well, you're right. You are right about that track record, and I started looking up some of the numbers, and I was referencing those quarterbacks. For example, Drew Brees is the most recent. He did it in 2009 and 2011. 2011, the Saints were 13-3. They put up 547 points. And then in 2009, they were also 13-3. They won the Super Bowl, and they put up 510 points.
Listen, if you complete 70% of your passes, I don't know if you're dinking and dunking, Anita, or you're throwing the ball 40 yards down the field. You're going to score points. You're going to accumulate a lot of yardage. You're going to keep the ball for a long time. I'd like to know what the time of possession was on those Saints teams versus the others. Although, who knows, maybe Brees was hitting long touchdown passes and the other team was getting the ball. But I want to control the ball, particularly when we get into the fourth quarter. I want to dominate the fourth quarter. Dominate the fourth quarter. And give us that, you know, continue with that field possession, putting pressure on the opposing offense to have to take it 80 yards instead of having to take it 55 yards. But hey, listen, I think the fact that the first numbers we saw came from the quarterback coach and applies to the quarterback. Look, it's about Eli. Because if you go back to Matt's call, three calls ago. You know, when you run down the core 10 for the Giants, when you get to 7, 8, 9, and 10, you start saying, uh-oh, question mark, injury. You know, I mean, we all love Beatty. We probably got him on our list, but, geez, I hope he stays healthy. And the same can be said from some other players. And I guess that's what Matt's point was. There are question marks about some of these guys who are on our core 10. I don't think we've got the personnel to win 12 games. I'll be surprised. But I sure would be happy with 4-2 in the division and 10-6 and playing football in January. And then, as everybody knows, anything can happen in January. You get a hot hand. By the way, 100 receptions for the running backs. That's my goal. Hey, guys, thanks. I appreciate it. It's a great show this morning.
You got it, Len. Thanks
you,
so much.
Terrific calls.
Just out of curiosity, have you and John done your whole, all right, let's go down the schedule, win, lose, win, lose, win, lose? Have you done that?
I mean, I've had conversations with other people within the organization. I just, you know, it's hard to speculate just because you never know how these teams are going to pan out.
I mean,
in
look,
the late
last year, so. The Texans and the Atlanta Falcons, we thought those two teams were just going to, like, kick butt and take names and make it to the playoffs. And both of them wet the bed in a big way. So you're absolutely right, but Do you want to just have some fun right now?
Well, when I did it, I believe I had 9 to 10. That was the barometer. I don't remember whether it was 9 or whether it was 10, but that was what I did. Normally what I do, I use the law of average when it comes to the division, and I split all those games because, you know, usually teams beat each other up in the division. And then outside of the division, then obviously I don't necessarily have to use the law of average. But that's what I do with the divisional games because, I mean, it's really tough to assume they're going to sweep everybody. That's why, to me, it's fair to split those games. And then, obviously, you can go through the list. But, you know, you look at the early stage of the schedule, Lions, I mean, that's a tough game because of a new coach. I know their defense is nothing to write home about, but they're going to be amped up, and I'm sure they're going to remember the game late last season. The Cardinals, I mean, that was essentially a playoff team last year. If the ball would have bounced their way or if a tiebreaker would have bounced their way. The Texans, you know, Houston on paper's got a number of issues, but, you know, Bill O'Brien takes over for the first time. You don't know how quickly that team's going to respond. You mentioned they get the Falcons. The Falcons are going to be healthy this year, you would assume. So that's going to help their case. That stretch with the Colts, Seahawks, and Niners after the bye is by far the toughest stretch, and all of those teams are coming back just as strong, even though Indy's lost a few running backs here or there. Titans, Jaguars, on paper, those are very much winnable games. I think they can certainly beat the Rams, too, even though the Rams' defense, to me, is probably going to be one of the surprises this season. So they have probably more depth than anybody else, and you have a couple of divisional games squeezed in. So, you know, on paper, I think this schedule is very challenging. It's no walk in the park, I'll tell you that, regardless of maybe a few winnable games here or there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're at Eagles, at Cowboys, then the bye, then Colts, Seattle, San Francisco, and then Cowboys again. That whole stint right there, that's rough. It's really rough. Don't sleep on the Cardinals. I don't think that's an easy give me win. Their defense, the way that Bruce Arians has that team playing, I think they're going to be a good team. And then the Texans, my goodness, with Clowney and J.J. Watt as bookend defensive ends, licking their chops, coming after Eli Manning, that frightens me.
The positive is at least they get the Texans at home as opposed to going to the dome. I think sometimes when you get a dome team out of its comforts, maybe you have a slight advantage. So that at least is a positive from a schedule perspective only. I mean, we don't know what the Texans are going to look like in week 3. But you're right. I mean, they got some young guys that they brought in to help that pass rush.
And everything I'm hearing about the Eagles, you know, I'm talking to Peter King, who spent time there. I'm talking to a number of the beat reporters, and, you know, because now you've got a lot of the reporters who work for the NFL Network and ESPN, and they're kind of doing their tours around camps. I'm hearing the Eagles are just Chip Kelly, his second year, the way that he has these guys. I'm hearing that the Eagles are going to be a force to be reckoned with. I think Eagles is the team in that NFC East division that everybody else has to really be ready for.
Well, and the Redskins concern me, too, given the fact that Jay Gruden is there. They have a new offensive philosophy. I think that they're going to give their defense a little bit more flexibility because Shanahan supposedly was a guy that was a little bit more controlling for what he wanted on the defensive side of things. So, you know, you can't necessarily overlook Washington. Plus, the Redskins have by far the best depth at wide receiver in this division. And I went over that a bit in the offseason, considering some of the guys they brought in, like Andre Roberts and DeSean Jackson, to complement Pierre Garçon. And they also have some up-and-coming tight ends. You mentioned Philly, though. I agree. I mean, Philly is certainly a team to watch. And Anita, I wouldn't say it so much because of the offense. To me, what's scary about Philadelphia is Bill Davis, their defensive coordinator. This is year 2 for him. And they first implemented that defense last year. Okay, it was a transitional period. That's why the defense struggled. Now you have these guys with a whole year under their belt. You would assume you're going to get off to a faster start because all of these players are digesting your principles now that it's the second year. So that means that Philadelphia could arguably be even stronger, given the fact that the defense has some more experience under its belt. 201-939-4513 is the telephone number. Let's head back to the lines. Hashtag Giants Chat you could use on Twitter. Alongside Anita Marks, I'm Lance Meadows. So glad you could join us for Tuesday's edition of Big Blue Kickoff Live. Frank is in Tampa. Frank, what's happening?
Good morning, guys. Good morning. Love your show this morning.
Appreciate that, Frank. What you got?
I'm going to try not to bring everybody down, but I got a few observations I'd like to make and then get your opinion on them. But, you know, I can't help but just as I'm sitting here running some numbers in my head when you're talking about, you know, 70% versus 66%, et cetera. So, you know, just sitting here, I'm adding up in my head, and I'm thinking, okay, if you're talking about like 40 throws a game. You know, 70% of that is 28. 66% of that is 26.5. So basically you're talking about the difference of about 20 to 25 catches over the course of the season, which comes to like, you know, one and a half catches, and which, you know, really, when you think about it, it seems almost meaningless. But then also, if you look at it a little other way, is that Eli, if those passes are shorter, then you end up maybe with a net negative by throwing for 70% in a West Coast than you do, you know, throwing the ball downfield. So, you know, you end up, you know, 70%, but less yardage. And then, you know, once again, I can't help but go back to the fact that I just think this is a square peg in a round hole. I mean, everything that, you know, I see that Rodgers and Breeze does well are the things that Eli doesn't, and I won't beat that horse again. But, you know, throwing on the run from different angles, different foot placement across his body, all those things that Eli does very poorly. And, you know, I won't go into things he does great because we all know about those, but he doesn't do those things well. He needs proper body mechanics. If they get disrupted, that's normally when it turns into a disastrous interception. And then getting back also to the interceptions you guys talked about, I don't think this offense is conducive to him throwing less interceptions, even if he completes, you know, 70%. I think it does more. I can't even remember, unless he just chucked it up at the end of the half or something, you know, the last time Eli threw an interception over, you know, 25 yards or so. He's very accurate on the long ball. It's the short balls that he's terrible on, and, you know, throwing at guys' feet and, overthrowing them on a 10-yard wide-open pass.
Well, hey, look, so just to explain to you, because I don't think a lot of people really understood how intricate Kevin Gilbride's system was. And I'm not in no way, shape, or form am I trying to talk down to you. I'm sharing just in case you're not aware. But normally in a normal offense, quarterback calls a play in the huddle. Everyone breaks. Wide receivers.
Yeah, we all know that, Anita. But
okay.
The thing is,
all right. So,
you know,
but
I think Bruce is ill-suited to this as well.
But listen. But let me finish. Let me finish. In Gilbride's system, that's not how it operated. You had receivers who went to the line of scrimmage, and they had to read the defense the same way that Eli had to read the defense. So and they weren't on the same page more times than not. So now you had a quarterback who's throwing a ball to a wide receiver who's not on the same page, who's not running the route that they need to throw, and when he makes his break, he's not where he's supposed to be. So to you and I, it might look like, oh, what's wrong with Eli's arm? He's throwing at his feet. Well, no. It was supposed to be a 10-yard comeback, not a 5-yard comeback. Oh, why is Eli throwing over there? Oh, well, it was a post corner. Wasn't supposed to be it's not a post. It was supposed to be a post corner. So, you know, there was a lot of miscommunication in that system.
Of course,
because this system, there's going to be no miscommunication. Guys are going to go to the line of scrimmage, and they are going to know exactly the pattern that they're going to run. And,
right,
and
we all know that. We've been talking about that for 6 months.
Okay, so then how can you? So then how can you say that you don't think a higher percentage rate is doable? Considering that
I didn't say it is. I didn't say it isn't. I'm just saying I don't think it's fit to his skills. And I'm talking about the balls that you can see where Myers is standing there and he throws it 4 feet over his head. We're not talking about the ones where it's disputed, where Eli's got his hand going left and right and Randall's got his head down. You know, we're talking about balls that just weren't thrown well to someone who was open, or he throws it behind him or whatever. But, I don't think that he threw many interceptions over 20 or 25 yards. His are mostly shorter, even on ones where there's no communication breakdown. And I also think that, you know, I hope I'm wrong, but I don't think that this system is really conducive to Cruz's skills. I mean, he has a unique ability to do exactly what you're just talking about, which is sight recognition and to understand what, you know, the defensive back is doing in conjunction with what Eli does. He's not the biggest. He's not the fastest. He doesn't have the best hands, but he does have that unique ability. And I think if you tell him just go down, run down 10 yards and make a left, I think that you are basically tying one of his hands behind his back, because I think that's his – I think that is actually his greatest skill. But, you know, these are just observations that I have. But the other thing I wanted to ask is about Beckham. You know, this hamstring has—it's got me really frightened. This is the most insidious of all injuries. You know, it is so many guys over the years. It can even be baseball, whatever. Once, if you are predisposed to that injury, it is a nightmare, and it never completely heals. You know, once you've torn those fibers, if you're predisposed to it, I mean, look at Miles Austin, right? Everybody thought he's going to be a top 10 receiver a few years back. He can't even get on the field. But that is, I mean, I call it the silent killer when it comes to ball players. And what it makes so difficult for a ball club is that not only game to game, but you often don't know play to play if you're going to have that guy. And it's one thing if he's, you know, your third receiver or whatever. But if you are intent on building an offense around the kid, now he's sitting there, he's not practicing, he's not learning the system, and now you don't know. I mean, to me, if he pulls this thing or tears this thing, I would venture to say that this will plague him the rest of his career.
Well, Frank, that's why they're resting him now. I mean, I understand the concern you have, but
the problem with it, rest doesn't help those things.
Well, I mean, listen, everybody's different. We can't assume that everybody's going to follow the track record of Miles Austin. And when you do have a hamstring issue, listen, it's not something to be very excited about. I'll give you that. Akeem Nicks had some issues that he fought through, you know, and he still was a productive player. Yes, he did miss a game here or there. So, you know, to assume that he's going to follow the same practices as these other guys, I mean, that to me is too much of a stretch. And also, you threw out the fact that you think that the Giants are trying to build the offense around him. I mean, I wouldn't go that far. I think this offense is where you can plug in a variety of different wide receivers, and the offense should still be able to click. So I even though he's a first-round pick, I don't think Ben McAdoo sat down after the draft and said, you know, the key of our offense is going to be Odell Beckham Jr., meaning if he's on the sideline, we're going to be screwed.
Yeah, no, I was exaggerating. But all I'm saying is that, you know, I know that they, you know, a number 12 pick, you are really counting on him. And that brings me to another thing, if I may. I'm a bit, I don't know what the word is, confused about the Walton and Richburg situation. I mean, if they felt and thought that Walton could win this job, I can't for the life of me understand if they wanted him to or not. And if he is going to, then why didn't they just draft the best guard in the draft? You know, I'm a bit confused by what happened.
Well, I think there was the injury concern, though, about J.D. Walton. You have to keep that in mind, Frank, the fact that he hadn't played in a game since 2012. So, you know, on paper, I'm sure they had confidence that he was going to win the job. But, you know, just like this Odell Beckham thing, you talked about how hamstrings reoccur. What happens if the ankle flares up again and then Walton's not ready to go? This way you have a center ready to go. And the good thing about Richburg is at least he's got some versatility. He can play the center and the guard position. So if he doesn't win the center job, he's the backup guard. If he wins the center job, then, God forbid, a guard goes down, you could always move him around and bring Walton in at center. So, you know, I think you at least have some flexibility there.
Right. Do you really like the thought, though, of picking 12 in the draft, and there's a distinct possibility that we have nobody from this year's draft class on the field when we start?
Well, Richburg, I don't think, is a concern. There's really no injury red flags with him. Beckham, I understand there's an injury red flag.
Playing. No, but not playing when we need.
You're talking about draft picks? Well, see, Frank, this is the cliche that's always thrown out. I hear this all the time on any program, any show I've done. First-round picks, second-round picks, they have to come in and immediately make a contribution, game-changer impact. And on paper, that's nice, but you also draft a guy so that you can get value out of him over the course of time. It's not as if you're looking to, you know, hit the iron immediately and all of a sudden fireworks are going to go off. So I understand in an ideal world, yes, you want Beckham to come in and you want to see instantaneous gratification. But they also drafted Beckham so that in year two, year three, year four, while that rookie deal is still protecting him, there's going to be consistent production. So I understand we all have the urge to say we've got to hit the home run. Listen, if he turns into be a consistent player in year two, year three, year four, I still think it's a great pick. Who cares what he necessarily does or doesn't do in year one?
Yeah, but except we need, I mean, with Nick's gone, we need a wide receiver to
well,
play.
But Frank, in fairness,
an offensive lineman to play.
In fairness, though, we have yet to see this offense in a game. Once we see this offense in a game, then I'll have a better read and a better gauge to tell you whether or not they need another Hakeem Nicks. But, you know, for all I know, they may be able to get due and get done with the running backs and the wide receivers they have, whether or not Beckham is fully healthy. I mean, I think right now we're stretching for conversation from that degree.
Yeah, we also needed an offensive lineman, though. Look what we get, you know, and looks like, you know, he's not going to be a starter either. So it's just, you know, it's a little troubling to me that I want to look back at the end of this year and say we got no production from, you know, any of our draft picks, because I think that's a disaster. But it's a great debate, and thank you, folks.
You got it, Frank, and appreciate the phone call. And I'm not saying they're not going to get any production out of any of their draft picks. I mean, these guys are going to get out on the field, but, you know, to say that they need to come in and hit a home run, you know, I mean, I think that is at least maybe putting expectations through the roof. I think if you could get, over the course of a rookie deal, if you look back at a player's contract and you say, you know what, over those 4 years, I got consistency out of my first-round pick, I think that's fine. Whether or not the home run came in year one or the home run came in year two, I don't know if that hurts that you took the guy 12th overall or 13th overall or whatever it may be.
I look at the draft that your first-round draft pick, in my opinion, needs to play and needs to really contribute that year.
But if you look at quarterbacks, too, sometimes you need development, and they don't necessarily reach their ceiling until year three, and there's plenty of quarterbacks that have gone in round one. So, you know, I mean, I think it may fluctuate depending on the position.
Yeah, but there's quarterbacks that have gone in round one that have, you know, immediately contributed.
True, but also a lot of it has to do with opportunity. I mean, Aaron Rodgers didn't come in, and that turned out to be a great pick for the Green Bay Packers.
Oh, that's because they had Brett Favre.
Well, but you could also make the argument, I mean, if Aaron Rodgers was put in that spot a year or two earlier, Green Bay could have still had a great season, given his talents and given his upside.
It's just my opinion. You know,
well, I'm not saying your opinion's wrong. I'm just saying we have that cliche all the time that we always throw out.
I think that's a luxury. I think, you know, if you're so stacked that you have a player that you can get in the first round, like a quarterback, and mentor and season and develop like they did with Aaron Rodgers, I think that's a luxury. But, you know, whoever you're drafting the first round, I'm expecting immediate impact. After that, well, then I think it's a crapshoot. Then I think you get lucky when your second, third, and fourth round pan out and can be a part and contribute. And then I look at, you know, fifth, sixth, and seventh rounds as projects. You know, Nassib is a project. So it's kind of how I view the draft. Not that it's right, not that it's wrong. It's just how I view the draft.
201-939-4513, 201-939-4513. Let's try to squeeze in a few more callers. Andrew's in Virginia. Andrew, what's happening?
Hey, guys. Good show so far.
Appreciate that, Andrew. What you got?
Based on the, you know, the outcome of last year, the Giants have one of the top five easiest schedules. However, there's no way to adequately prepare for this season's offense and see, like, well, we know what we have going into the season, so we can say win-loss. We absolutely don't know what the Giants have. I mean, you guys are there. We haven't seen any, you know, Sunday's game is the first opportunity we're going to see. And what is Eli going to play? You know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes? Is that going to be enough? I mean, we just don't know what we have on the field yet. We don't know if we're keeping two fullbacks, zero, five tight ends. We don't know what we have in a lot of these pieces. And with the new offensive line, to what degree do they have to be very good? I mean, Aaron Rodgers, every year, quick release, they have the ball out, clock, you know, under 2 seconds, whatever. You know, the ball just got to get out faster this year. And Eli has got, you know, everything that we've heard coming out of camp, and all the beat reporters and you guys have done a great job in letting us know what the priority has been. And it's footwork, get the ball out no matter what. Your feet are telling you that you have got to get the ball away, even if it's a throwaway. So I don't think the 70% mark for Eli is out of the question. I think the nature of the offense is going to be, especially coming off of last year where the ball just didn't get out and there were miscommunications. We know where the ball is going to have to be this year. We know the receiver is going to have to run a certain route. There are going to be adjustments and everything, but it's not going to be – the offense is not predicated on two different players making the same exact read, I don't think, as much as it was in Gilbride's system. So I don't think 70% is that much to ask. And in 2010, when Eli had 25 interceptions, what did he do the next year? He focused on his footwork. He checked it down an awful lot, and Ahmad Bradshaw had one of the great all-around running back performances that I've seen a Giant player have. He was there for the checkdown passes. He was a great blocker, and he ran hard. And that's what we need to get back to this year. And I think the offense is designed around quick attack, up-tempo, get the ball out, get it into people's hands so they can do what they do. And you look at all the offensive weapons that they brought in, including the people that we still have. Victor Cruz, 2011, just quick little slant or quick little cross and get him running in space. I cannot wait to see what we have. I hope that it all comes together. It starts gelling quickly. We just don't know it yet, and I look forward to Sunday night. Great show, and thanks for carrying us all off season long. Giants football Sunday night, baby. Let's go, Blue.
All right. Thanks so much, Andrew. Appreciate the phone call. In terms of what they need to get out of the offensive line that Andrew was talking about, yes, if the offense has a quicker pace to it, you know, you don't necessarily need guys that, you know, are going to block for 10 minutes, but you can't always assume that everything is going to be efficient. So that's why you need versatility on your offensive line. You also need guys that in the event the play breaks down, they're going to be able to protect Eli Manning. I don't think we can go into the assumption, well, every pass is going to come out within 2 seconds, so even if they have mediocre average offensive linemen who are not great at pass protection, Eli will be able to survive this season. That would happen in an ideal world. You have to prepare for the worst-case scenario.
In talking to a number of the offensive linemen, they're really excited about this offense. And yes, they're going in thinking, yes, we need to protect Eli Manning, but they're also saying the way that this offense is going to be run, the way that the scheme is, it's not so much on how much protection Eli Manning gets because he's going to be getting the ball off as quickly as he is. And that's exciting to them. You know,
well, it's also exciting to a lot of guys that, as you mentioned, have been playing in that Gilbride system. So, you know, something new can rejuvenate an offense and get everybody excited because, you know, they have an opportunity to redefine their careers and make some statements. And especially a guy like Eli Manning, who is trying to have a bounce back season, given all the interceptions and the sacks he took. So, you know, sometimes a new offense can save you and can also really mix things up well. So I think that that's another factor that comes into play as to why they're so excited. Let's finish up the program with one more phone call. We go to Charlie in Maine. Charlie, what's happening?
Hey, good morning. How are you all doing?
Doing all right, Charlie. What you got? Well, hey, what's irritating you this morning?
Well, piggybacking off Frank a little bit. What I don't understand is why is Coughlin so upset about Beckham? Tells me that he didn't want to pick him in the first round. That tells me one thing. I think he wanted to go with Martin. And look, this is like, you know, this is we got 5 preseason games. Why rush this guy? If he's got a hamstring, rest him. Who cares? You know, if he plays the 3rd preseason game, that's fine. He was in the OTAs. He knows the offense. He's been sitting there. He's been learning. Why rush this guy and cause more problems? I don't get it. But I understand. I totally agree with Anita. When you have a first-round pick and a second-round pick, they've got to play, especially when our team has massive holes in it and we didn't really do a great job in free agency to fill those holes.
Well, that's up for debate. But, Charlie, let me clarify something. I didn't say that they shouldn't play. Okay, I'm talking about getting a home run out of them. There's a distinct difference. Of course these guys should play, but everybody, the way they talk about them, is expecting this guy to come in and take this offense to levels that are imaginable, unimaginable. That, to me, is a little ridiculous.
Well, yeah, I'm not saying he's the number one receiver.
Well, that was the point that I'm getting to. You know, and I'm looking at some of the Twitter feedback. I never said that the guy shouldn't come in and play.
Right.
I'm talking
about
you can't expect him to come in and get 50 receptions for X amount of yards and 10 touchdowns. Come on.
Right. You know, I agree with you on that. And but he should be a number 2, maybe push Randall. At least he's got to be the number 3 guy coming in. And you got a guy, Bromley, now, who everyone's saying he's not even going to get a shirt on Sundays, a 3rd-round pick, kind of wasted. I don't know. Well, you know what I think about Reese. I just think he's terrible. But anyway.
Tell us how you really feel about him. Anyway.
I want to get into him again. But, I mean, we've got – I mean, that's the point I think Anita was making. I mean, if you're Seattle, then you don't need these guys to come in and play right. They're stacked. They got a team. But we had so many holes. And we need offensive linemen. Why aren't we getting guys, veteran guys in here? We're grabbing people off the scrap heap. This guy from Buffalo, you know, I mean, we keep getting Love, and we keep getting this guy and that guy. And they've all been on practice squads. They all played maybe one game. And you've got guys out there that are veterans. You've got Eric Winston out there. You've got Carl Nix. I don't know physically where
well,
he's
Carl,
at.
Well, Carl Nix is retiring. He's got no feet left. That's why he had to cut ties with the Bucks. I mean, if you're a line, but see, think about the guys you're naming, Charlie, and I brought this up a few shows ago. If you want them to pull these guys out of nowhere, off the market, and just because they're names, why are they on the market to begin with? Why are
they
on the market?
You said that about Will Hill, too, but he got signed.
Well, hold on. Will Hill, though, was still on the market because of the suspension. There's a difference between having baggage versus lacking talent.
What a great pickup that is for the Ravens. Whoa.
Yeah, what a great pickup.
Damn,
That's Ozzie Newsome saying we're protecting ourselves.
That's an absolute steal.
And by the way,
we could have done the same thing.
Charlie,
we could have had the same thing. We kept him and see what happened in 6 weeks.
I didn't mean to interrupt. I'll let you continue. The Seahawks have reportedly signed Eric Winston, so you can throw him off your wish list.
See? Well, there you go. Why would the Seahawks pick up Eric Winston if he sucks? Because he doesn't. They know talent. They know how to put – see, there's two ways to do things. We like to get guys to play multi-positions on everything, whereas Seattle, they take guys and they take their strengths and they utilize them in one area. That's why Sherman covers one side of the field. That's why this guy just plays left end. And they plug people in. Carroll is so smart in what he does in picking plays. Terrell Thomas, he knows exactly how he's going to use them, when he's going to use them, and he's going to be in that one position and just use them for that. Instead of like we do, try to move everybody around, have everybody play 16 positions just so they can save a little money in the cap so they can have one guy doing 12 things. It doesn't work that way because also you get, I don't know, it's just – you just look at Seattle, you can see the brilliance of what they do. They know how to take plays. Eric Winston, you were just saying, why is he on the market so long? Well, he isn't on the market anymore. We haven't even had the first exhibition game. And now we lose another talent that we could have had instead of Charlie Brown and the peanut
camp. But Charlie, if you think that the Seahawks just signed Eric Winston to be a starter, then you're living in fairy tale land, okay?
Do we need him for a starter? We need him as a good backup to Beanie. Charlie Brown is not the answer. He would have been a great backup to play two or three games if Beanie needed to sit out or if somebody got hurt. We had that guy in Booth. But Booth, we had him in center.
I understand that Charles Brown hasn't necessarily stood out in training camp. I'll give you that. And I'm not telling you on this program to get excited about him. But have you seen him in one preseason game? Did you watch all 16 Saints games last year? So how can you all of a sudden be down on a guy if you haven't even looked into his resume? I mean, granted, I understand he lost his starting job to Teron Armstead. But let's see a preseason game or two before we throw these guys to the fishes. I mean, come on.
I agree. But I'm just from what I'm hearing and what people, you know, are saying, Paul and everyone watching camp and watching practices, this guy hasn't stood out. That's all I'm saying. It seems like we have a hole in our offensive line, and we need to address it. Gooden played well last year. We let him go injury. I don't know what his injury was. Is it possible that we can bring him back? Because he played well towards the end of the year last year. That was a guy we were developing, and then we let him go. I don't know what the injury is. They didn't say, but I don't think it's career-threatening injury. So hopefully maybe they'll have some small back. And I just want to say one more thing and let you guys go. The return of the mummy Sunday night, Rasmus Bart, he will catch 2 touchdowns against us.
All right, Charlie. Well, at least you were able to liven it up at the end. Yes, referring to Ramsey's Bard, who actually is on the Buffalo Bills now, and he has been a big topic of discussion on this program, given the fact that you can't teach height, as we know, across the NFL landscape.
I thought he was going to go Sharknado on Wednesday night.
he chose the mummy because, you know, we obviously didn't see too much of Ramses Barden. It was a little clever on the part of Charlotte.
You know what? You saw a lot of Ramses Barden, and you saw Ramses Barden have success when he went up against defenses who played zone defense. Whenever anyone played man defense on Ramses Barden, he disappeared. Whenever a team played zone defense on Ramses Barden and Kevin Gilbride went to him, he excelled.
So basically you're referring to that Carolina Panthers game, and we could basically end the resume at that because I don't remember another game, Anita, that
they
even
zone.
Stood out.
Yep.
So, yes, he's got one game on his resume. Outside of that, perhaps the Hall of Fame preseason game will be number two. Time will tell. Well, great calls, great tweets, as usual. We'll be back up and running tomorrow, 9:30 a.m. Eastern.
Am I with you on Thursday? Are we back on Thursday?
I am not here on Thursday.
So I guess I'm with
Paul.
So
you're probably
Thursday.
With Paul or John, depending on what the convoluted schedule calls for. We need a medical degree to figure out who's hosting each and every day. With that being said, I will be back tomorrow with John Schmelk. So we look forward to the interaction from the callers and the listeners. Any tweets that we did not address on the program, try to address them after the program. The archive will be up shortly. And stay locked to Giants.com for all the latest news out of training camp. For Anita Marks, I'm Lance Meadow. Enjoy the rest of your Tuesday. Have a good one. We'll speak to you tomorrow.